Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Obama administration faces new questions about its support for a now bankrupt solar company. The energy secretary is testifying in defense of the hundreds of millions in loans Solyndra received. At stake is the loan program for renewable energy companies and perhaps even Steve Chu's job. Joining me here in the studio, Coral Davenport of the National Journal and Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners. Joining us from NPR's New York Bureau, Nathaniel Green of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and by phone from Phoenix, Robert Bryce of the Manhattan Institute. I know many of you have asked about Solyndra. This is your chance to get some answers. Do join us. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me start with you, Coral Davenport. Lay out the facts for us on Solyndra. What do we know and what is speculated about what happened with Solyndra?
Well, at this point, we know a great deal. Solyndra is a solar panel manufacturing company in Fremont, California. The Energy Department has this loan guarantee program. It's tens of billions of dollars, and the idea is to create financial backing for different energy projects around the country in order to stimulate and promote projects that might not be able to get off the ground otherwise. It's sort of created and mainly used for nuclear energy. But in the 2009 stimulus law, the administration decided to take that existing loan guarantee program and use it to back a lot of different renewable energy companies and programs around the country. And the first and biggest loan guarantee was for this company, Solyndra. As it was looking through at various companies and various projects it wanted to back, Solyndra emerged as what the administration thought was kind of a poster child, and in fact, people within the administration called it that, of what the loan guarantee program should be. And it concluded, it went through and authorized a $535 million loan guarantee for this company, Solyndra, by 2009. Pretty early on, soon after that loan was approved, and I should say that when the loan was approved, the administration made a very big deal about it. Joe Biden appeared via teleconference. Secretary Chu himself was at the groundbreaking. Later on, President Obama actually went and visited Solyndra and touted it as a great example of the success of this loan guarantee program and of the stimulus. But behind the scenes, we now know from these emails that have been revealed, there were a lot of problems with the financing of the company from day one. And there was a lot of concern within the administration, within the Energy Department, just about the financials, sort of about the basic makeup of the company. And soon after the loan guarantee was approved, the administration actually had to restructure the loan. It became clear that the company might go bankrupt. We also saw that the company at one point last year was going to do a large number of layoffs, and that the administration asked the company to wait to do the layoffs until after the 2010 congressional elections. And meanwhile, again, sort of behind the scenes, we now know there were many, many concerns about you know, the basic makeup of this company. And by this summer, it became clear that the company was probably going to go bankrupt. It asked for additional financing from the loan guarantee program. The administration did not give it. The company went bankrupt by September. And had to lay off 1,000 employees. And this ended up being a terrible black eye for the administration, for the Energy Department, for the Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, all the more so because they had touted it, you know, so publicly, and because this administration has become so associated with renewable energy.
Coral, let me ask you just one question. How many other companies received money from this loan guarantee program?
It's dozens. I know that the loan guarantee program from the stimulus was for $16 billion. So the Solyndra, although it was a very large loan guarantee, it was $535 million. So it was a tiny portion of all the loan guarantees that were given out.
So turning to you, Kevin Book, what kinds of questions do you expect Secretary Chu to receive today? What do you expect the outcome of today's hearing?
Well, good morning, Diane. The questions are almost always going to be political at this point because it has become essentially, as Coral said, it was highly celebrated by the administration as a political achievement. The loan guarantee program was bipartisan in its creation in 2005 in the Energy Policy Act. It was the modification in 2009 that enabled conventional renewable projects like Solyndra to get not just loan guarantees, but to get the insurance on those loan guarantees essentially paid for by the federal government, enabling smaller companies and more cash-poor companies to play in the space. And that program itself is something that I think probably should be discussed, but probably they'll be focusing on the project and the process, which is to say, what did you know about Solyndra and when did you know it, and how did you end up making the decision to fund it? Those will be most of the questions. Some Republicans probably will also veer into the realm of purpose, and that being the question, I think, whether or not the federal government should be involved in the business at all. Now, for my part, I think that the questions of project and process are already becoming very well documented. As an analyst myself, in 2008, we published a report that showed a huge potential production of non-Solyndra-like solar products, the conventional polysilicon product. And part of what Solyndra ran into was a market that was suddenly saturated with a regular solar panel that didn't need Solyndra's cool new solar panel. And so part of what's happening here is really the project-specific questions probably deserve to be answered. But today, I think what you'll end up with is mostly political theater.
When you say the project-specific questions should be answered, what kinds of questions would you want answered?
Well, this is a financing question, and the question is this company going to be viable when it receives the financing it's getting from any source, whether it be public or private? And the viability was going to be a function of its cost structure and its ability to compete in a market that wasn't well understood or defined. When Solyndra first got involved, they were on a cutting edge at an opportunity to really play in solar when every other kind of solar panel was really expensive. As the costs of manufacturing fell with Chinese manufacturing cost decreases and scale increases everywhere else, they became less viable. And it may have been worth reconsidering the whole idea of funding them.
And you've heard from Kevin Book. He is with Clearview Energy Partners. Coral Davenport is with National Journal. Turning to you, Robert Bryce, what do you see as the lesson in the case of Solyndra?
Well, that's a good question, Diane. I guess I'd rather than talk about what the lesson might be, I'd rather talk about the contrast between this blow-up, really, for the Obama administration and the Solyndra deal and their cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, the Obama administration, they're going to wait until after the election. But it's a question of scale, and it's one that I voted for Obama. I wish him well. I won't vote for him again. But when it comes to energy policy, it seems that the Secretary Chu and the President have no concept of scale. They have no idea about the quantity of hydrocarbons that we use or their importance. So how do you explain that? Well, last year, if you look at all the wind energy and all solar energy produced in the United States, According to the Energy Information Administration, it was about 96 million megawatt hours of electricity. Well, you can convert that into oil equivalents. It turns into about 160,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. The Keystone XL pipeline by itself was designed for 700,000 barrels a day. Even if we reduce that by two-thirds to account for the energy loss in converting hydrocarbons into electricity, we're still talking about 230,000 barrels of oil equivalent, or 44% more than all of the solar and wind energy production in the United States last year. And that was from one pipeline. So to me, it's indicative of the Obama administration's, I think, truly wrongheaded focus on almost solely on renewables.
All right.
While the administration won't talk about oil and gas, and in fact actively works to prevent development of oil and gas.
Robert Bryce of the Manhattan Institute, I want to turn quickly to you, Nathaniel Green, get you to talk specifically about Solyndra and what this hearing and what this controversy is going to mean for alternative energy.
Well, let me first say I'm really happy to be here. I've listened to the show so many times, it's nice to actually be on it.
Thank you.
And let me say I am a wonky wonk. I agree with a lot of what Kevin said about what this, what the debate is really and what the hearing is going to be about today.
Okay, Nathaniel, I just want to let you know we're coming up on a break. And what I'd like you to do, if you would, is to hold your comments until after we come back. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Short break and right back. And we're back talking about Solyndra. Secretary of the Interior, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu is testifying on Capitol Hill today on that controversy involving Solyndra. We have four people with us, and I was talking just before the break with Nathaniel Green, Director of Renewable Energy Policy at the Natural Resources Defense Council. I was asking you, Nathaniel, before I had to cut in, about the impact Solyndra and the controversy on it will have on renewable energy.
Thanks, Diana. I was saying that, you know, I'm a wonk. I wish, like Kevin was saying earlier, that we were having a discussion, a national discussion about the process, about this project, about how to perfect our policies to turn American leadership in developing renewable energy technologies. Let's remember that solar power, wind power, geothermal power, these are technologies that Americans invented, Americans have innovated, Americans have brought to the point of commercial competitiveness. We should be figuring out how to perfect the policies to help bring those out of the lab and into the marketplace. And instead, what we've got is a political witch hunt going on. And, you know, I'm a father of two girls. I'm a homeowner. Important for this conversation. I'm a taxpayer. I want to make sure our tax dollars are spent well. And that's really what we should be talking about. But let's remember, every major technological innovation, from the railroads to the cars to aviation to the internet, these are all technologies that America has led and that the government has really helped move from the lab to the marketplace. And we should be doing the same thing with clean energy. And that's really what we need to move the debate towards, away from this gotcha politics that's really dominating Washington these days.
And, of course, you heard Robert Bryce say that the contrast between Solyndra and the administration's postponement of the pipeline from Alaska down to Mexico has been put off. What's your reaction there?
Well, you know, this administration has approved more offshore drilling than the Bush administration. I don't think this administration has a problem with embracing fossil fuels. I think, though, you know, his discussion of scale is an interesting one, because in 2009, renewable electricity generated more electricity in the United States than nuclear power. So if we're saying that renewables are too small, well, then what does that say about nuclear industry? And I think most Americans just get the idea that rather than pouring more money down a hole after fossil fuels that are only getting dirtier and more dangerous and more difficult to get, we should be trying to really take advantage of our leadership, our innovation, our ability to generate this new technologies that capture fuel that's free today. It's going to be free tomorrow. It just never going to run out. This is where the world's going. Every month there's more and more renewable energy. And we can either lead or we can follow.
All right. And to you, Robert Bryce, the Secretary of Energy is testifying that in the past year and a half, the China Development Bank has offered more than $34 billion in credit lines to China's solar companies, and that other countries are doing the same, Germany and Canada. So the question comes, do we want to lead or do we want to be at the end of the line?
Well, and Secretary Chu, Diane, at the end of his testimony, says, when it comes to the clean energy race, America faces a simple choice, compete or accept defeat. I believe we can and must compete. Okay, well, on clean energy, the president himself has identified natural gas as clean energy. When it comes to natural gas, the U.S. is light years ahead of every other country in the world in terms of the exploitation of shale gas, and we're going to maintain that lead for a long time to come. The idea that somehow we're behind or that we should be subsidizing and extending these kinds of credits to companies in the United States, I think, is just is wrong. What's happening in Europe? The Dutch have just dramatically cut their renewable subsidies. The Germans have done the same. The Spaniards have done the same. Final point. What's the most admired company in the United States? I would argue it's Apple. What does Apple do? They design their products here, and they manufacture them in China. Well, where's the discussion then about our need for cell phone independence or laptop independence? The justification for, in my view, for a lot of these subsidies for the solar and wind business are very similar to the subsidies the justification we heard from the corn ethanol scammers. It's a view that somehow we're going to be isolated, or somehow that we have to subsidize this industry even though it can't compete globally.
Kevin Book.
I think that there's a certain sentiment that the whole idea has to be repudiated. And what I would argue in sort of contrast to that is that maybe it just needs to be done right. The original Title 17 program was designed to be a portfolio of 10 different types of technologies. And the basic rule was either it makes things cleaner or it makes us more secure. And almost immediately after agreeing on these very good principles, Congress started to parcel out where they wanted to spend the money, which immediately subverted the idea of being technology neutral, which was good. And then in 2009, they took a really bad step, if you ask me. They went ahead and decided to use this as a stimulus idea. There are other ways to stimulate jobs through green power, and the administration did those things too with congressional support. They spent money on new credits. They turned tax credits into cash. doing this was probably going a bit far in the sense that it debalanced the portfolio. That portfolio, as Coral said, was supposed to be anchored by a relatively low-risk investment in clean nuclear power. Not everyone thinks of it as clean, of course, but the idea was that that would give you the balance so that you could take some moonshots. And so in my own testimony on the Hill, when I've talked about this, I've tried to be very clear that I think that what you needed was actually a green bank. You shouldn't be talking about whether or not we're competing unfairly. We should be trying to do it right in the first place.
Coral Davenport, 38 companies received loans from this loan development group. How many of them have been successful? How many of them are still in business and moving forward?
38 companies received the loan guarantees, and two have failed. That's so far it appears that's a successful ratio. If you talk to financial experts, they'll say generally, that's a pretty good result. When in these programs, the whole point of this program was, as Kevin said, to have a couple of moonshots. That's the expectation. And the Energy Department also budgeted in advance for some of these companies to fail. They put aside $10 billion with the expectation that some of these companies that received backing would fail. That's written into the principles of the program. So with $10 billion there, so far you've lost $535 million.
Generally, all right, so $535 million gone down the drain, Solyndra failed. But the other controversial element here is that Solyndra turned around and gave the Obama administration a campaign donation.
Yes, and that's or one of the investors in Solyndra, George Kaiser. The documents and emails that have come out don't seem to have revealed anything illegal. But it continues to politicize this debate so much. And, it's clear that Republicans on Capitol Hill who are looking to, cut programs specifically for renewable energy, to cut financing for renewable energy, are going to continue to wield this episode.
Stephen Chu also says that he made the final decisions on Solyndra and that he did not make any decision based on political considerations. But that's where Congress is likely to go.
That's where the questioning is definitely going to go today. Again, Kevin talked about keeping the debate on the process and looking at what happened, step by step, but the debate is not going to leave the political suggestions.
All right, we've got lots of callers. I'm going to open the phones now, first to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Bobby.
Yes, hello. I'm calling. There's no question that the country needs to invest in alternative energy. However, what political parties or politicians have received donations for making these loans? And of course, it would be at no cost to the companies since the loan amount can be increased to cover the bribe.
Coral.
Bribe is a strong word. I don't think that we've seen any connection between, specific campaign donations and these loan guarantees. I'm not sure that we're seeing that direct connection.
But talk about that, Kevin Book. I mean, it does seem somewhat suspect that the individual who is a supporter of Solyndra, an investor in Solyndra, would then, after receiving the $535 million loan guarantee, would then make a substantial donation. I don't know how much. Do we know how much? Why not?
Well, I'm sure it is actually probably a matter of record because these things go into the FEC database. Diane, I've done a lot of work looking at how these decisions on energy policy get made. It's part of what my investor clients are always curious about, which is they've done the math. Now tell us what's going to happen that we can't understand. And about 80% of energy policy decisions made on Capitol Hill have a local basis. They're economically good for what's in the ground at home. And that goes back over about 10 Congresses. And so it's not unusual that you would see local influence applied both legislatively and then subsequently through the regulatory process. Now, that may be seeming ugly, and it's a sort of scandalous sounding.
The system works.
But we have a citizen government in a market democracy, and it's kind of how the system works, yeah.
All right, two new
bits. Can I jump in for just
sure,
a minute?
Do.
So I agree with Kevin in the regard that I think clearly there needs to be reform in this loan process. To me, the poster child for how this process has really jumped the tracks is the Shepherd's Flat Wind Project in Oregon. It's a $2 billion wind project, 850 megawatts. Who are the big players in that project? It's General Electric, along with a couple of partners, Google and Sumitomo. General Electric has a market capitalization of $170 billion, and yet for this project, they got a loan guarantee of $1 billion, and when the project is completed, they and their partners will collect $490 million in cash from the U.S. Treasury. Why are U.S. taxpayers subsidizing General Electric? This makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Nathaniel Green, how would you respond to that?
You know, I think what these programs were starting to do, were set up to do, is to fix a financial system that is loaded towards the fossil fuel industry and the sort of traditional technologies, and went through an incredible financial collapse in 2008. And so we were trying to create liquidity and make these projects happen. And what I don't understand is why, when it's the nuclear power industry, when it's the oil industry, and we're letting these people basically pollute into our air, which is a huge subsidy to them, we don't talk about that. But when we try to get American technology, renewable energy technology into the marketplace, suddenly that becomes an unacceptable investment in our country.
Nathaniel Green, he's director of renewable energy policy at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Back to the phones to Tom in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. 2 points about this loan guarantee. One, loan guarantee programs are intended to assist the development of new cutting-edge technologies, and as such, it's almost guaranteed that a certain percentage of them will fail. And secondly, just one of Halliburton's no-bid contracts in Iraq was worth $7 billion. That's 14 times the amount of this loan guarantee. And if this is the worst that the Obama administration has done, I think they're doing a pretty good job.
All right. And Bryce, I wonder if you'd respond to, these loan guarantee programs are probably expected in some percentage to fail.
Well, there's no question about that. And to be clear, I'm not opposed to solar. I live in Austin, Texas. I have solar panels on the roof of my house. Why did I put them in? Well, the city of Austin gave me a big subsidy to do it. So the question, though, going forward is, how long do we need to subsidize these different energy sources? If you look back in history, the U.S. has spent billions on renewables over the past 60 years. I just looked at EIA data. In 1949, renewables' share of the U.S. primary energy mix was 9.3%. In 2009, it was 8.2%. Now, yes, we can talk about solar and wind and the need to bolster them and so on, but the reality is if government is going to take – the proper role for government, I think, is to assure cheap, abundant, reliable energy. Cheap, abundant, reliable. And what we see with solar right now is that it's at least three times as expensive as natural gas-fired electricity. Those are EIA data that are available to everyone. So I think the government's focus in all of this should be, how can we reduce costs? How can we make it more abundant? How can we make it reliable? And those are particularly important now, given the state of the United States economy and the number of people that are collecting food stamps and are on unemployment.
Kevin Book.
Well, Diane, I think Robert's actually on the cusp of some of what I've been trying to get at, which is that there's a right way and a wrong way to finance things. And for large infrastructure projects, loan guarantees lower the cost of capital for the project sponsor. Right. That's generally the difference between something happening and something not happening, particularly if your utility and a new nuclear plant can't fit on your balance sheet. And we have tax credits that have been used in far greater amounts. I think that's most of what he's talking about here. The ethanol tax credit is a favorite target, I think, on this show and probably others. But the wind and solar tax credits as well. And what I'm suggesting is that if you're going to give out one, why give out both? Why go all three barrels firing? Perhaps what's wrong here is that there isn't a single way to coordinate these. As I think Robert said, at the end of that wind farm project, they're going to have a cash stream that comes from the tax credits from the wind, plus they got a low-cost loan. And the question is, can you balance this in a way that's more fiscally prudent so that you're giving other players a chance and not crowding them out?
Coral Davenport, do you want to comment?
Well, you know, I would just note that the federal government has been in the business of subsidizing and promoting different kinds of energy, you know, for decades. There are, you know, $4 billion in annual subsidies and tax breaks given out to the oil industry. Some of those have been in place since 1916. So you know, part of what is going on here is kind of a balancing. I mean, this administration is trying to change that balance, to change that perspective.
Coral Davenport of National Journal. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
Diane Keaton is known to millions as Annie Hall. In a new memoir, the award-winning actress talks about life off-screen and the bond she shared with her mother. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones to John in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Talking about the subsidies, it seems to me that if you look into all the details, that non-renewables have already been subsidized enormously, probably far more than renewable has. If you look at everything that the government actually pays for.
Robert Bryce, do you want to comment?
Well, sure. Let me just make a quick point, and it's on what's happening in the shale, in the natural gas and oil sector in the United States. It's true that the U.S. oil and gas industry has had subsidies in the form of tax credits and in forms of deductions for intangible drilling costs, depletion, et cetera, for decades. But what is the most important development in the U.S. energy scene? In fact, what I would say probably the world energy scene in the last 20 to 30 years, it's shale gas and shale oil. This has been the best possible news for U.S. consumers in the last couple of years at a time when other commodities are going up in price dramatically. The price of natural gas has fallen dramatically. And in fact, if you just look at from 2005 to 2008, the price of natural gas was over $7. Now it's under $4. It's saving U.S. consumers at least $80 billion a year.
But back to his question,
yeah,
it's hard to say that renewable energy should not get as much in the way of subsidies as the oil and gas companies have received over the years.
Okay, well, and that's a fair argument. But my point is that what has happened in the oil and gas industry has lowered the cost of natural gas to the point where renewables are simply not cost effective. So we could say we can subsidize renewables, but if you listen to Boone Pickens, he says natural gas has to be at $6 for wind energy to be cost effective. Solar's twice as expensive as wind.
All right, Nathaniel, you want to come in?
I do. I think there's especially when we talk about the loan guarantee and the programs that came out of the stimulus bill, it's important to distinguish between the sort of ongoing subsidies that we've used in the oil and gas sector, which are really trying to buy down the cost of fuel, of an inherently limited fuel base that's getting dirtier and more difficult and more dangerous. I mean, how many more people need to get stuck down in coal mines, or how many more valleys do we need to fill with mountaintop removal? How many more oil spills from pipelines do we need before we understand that there are real costs, there are subsidies? We're putting our lands, our public health, as a sort of subsidy to the fossil fuel industry. And when we think about that just ongoing cost, that just growing, mounting pile of money that we have to and health costs that we have to pay to that industry, versus the renewable industry, where we're trying to do something fundamentally different. We're trying to get a technology to the point where it is the most reliable, the most cheap, the best for our public health, and can really be, and it's already starting to take off around the world. Yeah. So it's a different type of subsidy. It's really much more of an investment. And I think, we all of us that have homes or have ever taken out a loan, we understand the idea. You make an investment up front, you get the benefit over a long period of time. And this is when we've made a lot of investments in this technology, innovating, developing the technology. Because we've pulled the rug out from under this industry a few times already in the last few decades, we've seen a lot of the manufacturing move overseas. So now I think we have a fundamental choice. Are we going to, every other technological revolution we've gone through has made our lives better, has made us richer as a country. This one can do all of that and make us healthier.
Coral.
Diana, I think at this point, sometimes it's useful in the debate to step back and think, what is actually the overall policy or principle that the administration is trying to promote here? And the broad energy policy that the Obama administration is driven by is not actually about necessarily creating a specific industry. It's not about sort of picking and saying, we want to grow industry X. It's about reducing our consumption and dependence on oil, and it's about reducing fossil fuel emissions, carbon emissions. That is certainly for Energy Secretary Chu and for this administration, that's the idea. So when you say, all right, in order to do that, you need to use less oil and you need a different kind of energy to come in and take its place. And there's a long-term, they're trying to start a long-term transition to using a different kind of energy. So they're looking and they're saying, well, these are the different kinds of energies that can slowly replace the oil that we use. And yes, they are more expensive. And the idea is, the administration's idea is, you give these a boost. You help them out until they get cheap enough that you don't have to make that choice as a consumer.
Ron in Fort Worth, Texas asks, had Solyndra given any big bonuses to their executives? And if not, where did all the money go? Coral.
We have not seen in the emails particular notice about bonuses or compensation for the employees. But as Kevin pointed out, essentially the financing was poorly structured and the market changed. The market for solar panels, the product that they were making, essentially the Chinese flooded the market with a cheap alternative. So, consumers were not going to buy the product that they made.
Interesting, Kevin.
Well, I'm not a big fan of promoting trade wars, and particularly not during recessions. History says that's a bad idea. So blaming the Chinese isn't necessarily the right way to go here. There was a problem, which was that to make polysilicon panels, you needed to turn trichlorosilane gas into polysilicon. And there were only a few companies in the world that could do that. And the ramp up in solar, spawned mostly by Germany in the middle part of last decade, made the market very tight. The Chinese were the ones who broke open the market with supply. But if they hadn't been, someone else would have. And that's the point. The point is that the technology Solyndra was pioneering was only going to work at a price point where effectively other solar panels would be too expensive. And I think where Robert's going, in essence, is part of the point, which is that our government does want cheap energy. That is why we have oil tax treatment the way we do. And if you look at what EPA just did, they just permitted a fossil-fueled power plant in California as compliant with greenhouse gas reductions because it uses a parabolic trough, a solar reflector, to create some of the energy for the plant. So to give you a comparable here, it's sort of wonky, and Nathaniel may be the only one who appreciates it, but a regular natural gas plant is about 850 pounds carbon dioxide per megawatt hour. This one's about 775. And the point is that solar is being used in the plant, even though it's a conventional plant, to make it cleaner. There are applications here that aren't pure play, and they won't come out if you don't spend some money.
All right, let's go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I got a question. I'd like someone to address a bigger question. Is why do so many people think it's appropriate for the U.S. government to play venture capitalists with taxpayer money? And I, as a former VC myself, I don't remember once in my long career anyone leaving the industry to go work for the U.S. government. I don't remember in grad school anyone foregoing a career in the private sector to go work for the U.S. government. So who are these people making these decisions? And venture capital is very risky. I mean, it's appropriate for college endowments, pension plans. For every apple, you have 6 to 10 that flame out and never produce anything. But for some reason, many people think that the U.S. government can play venture capitalists with taxpayer money. And
Coral.
Well, and once again, that's kind of the point. That is the principle of a lot of these programs is that they're funding technologies that cannot get the funding anywhere else. The idea is a sunshot or a moonshot, in the same way that the federal government funded research through the Pentagon that led to breakthrough technologies like the internet. The idea is, these technologies are so sort of, high risk, high reward that they would not get funding anywhere else.
And from the hearing earlier, Congressman Henry Waxman, in his opening statement, declared, "We can't lose this race." But Congressman Cliff Stearns from Florida says, "If we intend to subsidize our industries to compete with China, who subsidized their energy? That's not a good way to handle it." And Secretary Chu said, "Countries like China are playing to win in the solar industry." Is that how you see it, Kevin?
Yes. China actually did play to win. The solar industry it's got two parts. It's got the manufacturing and the installation. And the manufacturing is a factor cost driven business. Low labor costs, weak environmental rules, cheaper stuff, and you win. The installation, you can do better, you can do it more efficiently, but there's limits to how squeezed those margins can get in the countries where you install. We've tightened up on installation about as much as we can get, but there's just simply factor cost differences. It's hard to see how we will win the solar manufacturing race without a new technology.
Nathaniel, why don't you talk about why you believe it's important that the U.S. win this race?
Well, I think it's important because we all want jobs. We all want to have a high quality of life. We all want to have clean air and clean water for our kids and for ourselves. And, the alternative is either we keep using dirtier and more dangerous and more difficult to get fuels, or we buy the clean energy technologies from overseas, or we lead. I mean, again, we develop this stuff. We are the innovators. We made this technology work. Now we you know face the prospects of seeing it all go overseas. And you know, we have actually been exporting solar technology, exporting components around the world in the last few years. And so that's why, you know, it's not – I just don't buy Representative Stern's idea that we have to wave the white flag and give up. That's just not the American way.
All right,
when
yeah.
it comes to – to the marketplace.
Hold on 1 second, because yeah. I want to read a posting on Facebook from Wayne. The government does not operate like a venture capitalist, investing in companies with the hope of reaping a profit for itself. Compare the effort to trigger a green energy industry to government-funded cancer research. Some directions of exploration don't pan out, but you don't know that until you fund the tests. And this is what happened with Solyndra. Now to you, Robert Bryce, your comment.
Well, just a couple of quick things. Coral said, you know, mentioned this idea of moonshots, and we've heard that kind of discussion many times. Well, giving a loan guarantee to General Electric and nearly $500 million as a cash grant, this is not a moonshot. This technology now with wind energy has been well known for a long time. Regarding jobs, last December, the Comptroller of Public Accounts in Texas, which has more installed wind generation capacity than any other state, looked at the cost of each wind-related job in the state and estimated each one of those jobs cost the state $1.6 million. So, look, this idea that we have to win this or all this technology is going to go overseas, the people who are going to win in markets, whether you're talking about fresh flowers, bottled water, tennis rackets, tennis shoes, or solar panels, are going to be the low-cost producers. Again, I go back to my point on Apple. Where's the outrage from the green left about Apple producing all of their products overseas? Explain the difference to me.
Robert Bryce of the Manhattan Institute. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you want to explain the difference, Kevin Book?
Well, the main difference is that energy infrastructure is something that sits around in your country for a long time. The turnover, there is no Moore's Law, for example, in energy technology, the same way there is in the semiconductor devices we're talking about. You have rapid turnover at a relatively low cost point for those devices. For running shoes, the same is true. This is stuff that you're going to have around for a while, and the jobs that are going to be related and supporting to service and upgrade and maintain that infrastructure are going to be part of your high-paid workforce for some time.
We've had one of our callers say that it's too vague to answer that the money left because they were too poorly structured. Can we be more explicit about that $535 million? Kevin.
Diane, I suspect we can. Part of the question is whether they really did misallocate funds internally for some reason, not necessarily malfeasance, but just bad judgment. It isn't clear that this rode home in a Porsche every night or had lavish parties with ice sculptures. But it also seems surprising in light of the scale of the investment they must have undertaken, must have either been outside the bounds of a really good choice, given the market we had. They ran through it awfully fast. I think so. We'll have to find out, though. And that's a forensic investigation. It involves financial analysis and really second-guessing an executive, which isn't necessarily something I'm prepared to do today.
But to what extent does the Department of Energy carefully look at each of these applications and run through the structure, run through the planning before it begins spending a loan guarantee?
Well, as Secretary Chu said in his testimony today, he stands by that all of the applications are reviewed rigorously. There's a full staff. And one of the things that's concerning about the Solyndra loan guarantee is he said everything was done with rigor and correctness in the evaluation of the Solyndra loan guarantee, which causes some concern because it means that nothing was anomalous, nothing was done wrong, nothing was left to chance. It means they used the analysis for Solyndra that they're using for everything else. There was one point, though, with the loan guarantees that were specific to the stimulus. There was a deadline for them. The loan guarantees had to be completed. The money had to be allocated by a deadline of September 30th, 2011, which means something that we've seen is that they were rushing towards the end to make sure that all of those applications were reviewed and the money got out the door in time.
Is Secretary Chu likely to lose his job over this? Coral.
There's a lot of speculation about this. What we saw from his testimony this morning is he came in on the offensive. He is not apologizing. He did not signal in any way that he intends to resign. It seems very likely, however, that he might leave after the elections.
Kevin Booth.
Well, if somebody has to take the fall, the guy who says it's my responsibility is my first nominee.
Kevin Booth. He is with Clearview Energy Partners. Coral Davenport of National Journal, Robert Bryce at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future, and Nathaniel Green of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you all, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot.